Well, the last meeting was an open informal meeting, and I think most of you are at the meeting. It was opened by Dave Webb, discussion of humanoid cases that occurred in New York and New Jersey area. He passed on a copy of a very well-done newspaper article, which Peter Miles has managed to make copies of for us. Then there was some discussion of a new book by Hayek and Valet called The Edge of Reality, and several other local cases and investigative problems were discussed. I really don't want to go through all this information because most of the people here know it.
Well, you can, you know, chop it down as well.
Okay.
You got to keep it going. You
got a couple of minutes. I did say that the next meeting would be held here in Madison, New Hampshire. And it was suggested that the following meeting be a presentation by Ray Fowler, the most up-to-date slideshow. Now, I approached him on this, and he didn't really say no.
All right, that's a yes.
That's a yes, all right. But
at his house?
We won't get him anyplace else, so if we want to volunteer...
Just say, we make a vote that it'll be at Ray's house. He'll provide the entertainment.
Yeah, you want
He didn't really object. He didn't say yes. His problem is whether his schedule was free. But we may free it for him. I'm not sure.
He has a telescope and a planetarium. But you ought to mention that.
We have to make
too.
Sure that it's a secure night.
Yeah. Well, didn't
yeah.
say.
Put that in the order.
Planetariums work on any night, but telescope.
At the last meeting, we also suggested to Ray that he publish in Skylark the sample case. That's not what it is.
Come on in.
Betty.
Hi.
Come on in.
Hey, I'm sorry. I was in the middle of a little project here.
Hi. How are you doing? Let me take the coats upstairs.
Just a minute. I got to straight down.
Right. I'm Chip Hayward.
This is Dave Downs, and we'll have a little bit more introductions later on. This is Mr. and Mrs.
Sheehan.
Sheehan, right? How are you, Dave?
Fine.
Okay, I guess we're ready to continue on. And if there's nothing more to do than with the minutes of the last meeting, well, so Joe, have we covered everything in regards to that?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Well, perhaps we might get into talking with Betty tonight. Do you have anything planned as to what you'd like to start off with the slides and things?
Well, first of all, I'd just like to go over my experience briefly, and then I'll show the slides.
Okay, I think that'd be...
And then open it up for questions and answers, and then I've got a few questions to ask.
Okay, very good.
Oh, that's good.
Okay.
Well, I'll just give a brief introduction. As many of you know, Betty Hill was abducted on a UFO on September 19th, 1961. And I'll just let her take the story from here, but I don't want to tell her.
Okay. I'm going to stand up for that.
Very good.
I'm out of the habit of standing up. Okay. So I'm going to start here, first of all, and tell you about the experience that Bonnie and I had. We left Portsmouth, went up to Niagara Falls, to Toronto, Montreal, Canada. And now it's September 19th, 1961. And we left Montreal in the afternoon, crossed over the border. And at 10 o'clock that night, we stopped in Colebrook, New Hampshire, to get gas for the town and have a snack. We left Colebrook at 10 and started down through the White Mountains of New Hampshire. It was a Tuesday night. It was after 10, riding during the night. There was no traffic on the highway. We rode for miles. And all of a sudden, I saw what I thought was a new star in the sky. And while I was watching this, it started to move. So we thought it was a satellite, because satellites in 1951 were still somewhat of a novelty. So we pulled over the side of the road to look at the satellite. I took the binoculars and I got out, and I looked at it as it was going across the face of the moon. And right from the first moment I looked at it, I didn't know what it was, but I knew it was not a satellite. And I knew it was nothing that I had ever seen before. I returned to the car after giving the binoculars to Barney, and he watched it. While he was watching it, it turned and started coming towards us. We got back in the town, we started driving. He was driving, I was watching. And I was watching the object coming closer and closer. Actually, I was just fascinated by the way it was maneuvering. Because this was doing, at the time, I couldn't describe it. I was saying it was jumping all over the sky. Now, I know it was doing 90-degree angle turns, and it was doing the step, what I call the step-by-step process of going around and dropping down this way, and going this way, and this way, and coming down lower. And then it gave the appearance of spinning. And then it looked like a steady light until it came to the top of the mountains, the contours of the mountains, and it was following along the tops of these. Until we came to an area called Indian Head. And at that point, it left the top of the mountain and came out over Route Strait and stopped. And I looked up at it through the binoculars. I could see a double row of windows and a red light on each side. Bonnie took the binoculars and he was going to get out and identify this as something conventional. Because Bonnie, as far as UFOs were concerned, was very close-minded. He was absolutely positively sure, without a shadow of a doubt, there was no such thing. So he took the binoculars and he started walking towards this object. And as he did, he could see a group of human-like figures looking down at him. And he was looking up through the binoculars, and one was saying to him, stay right there, and just keep looking. Just keep looking. Don't be afraid. No harm's going to come to you. Just keep looking. And as that happened, you could see the red lights on each side part and come out at the end of fin-like structures, and the craft tilted and started to come down towards him. At that point, Bonnie had the feeling he was going to be captured. He ran back to the car, yelling, we had to get out of there, we're going to be captured. We took off speeding down the highway, and there was a series of beeping sounds, beep, 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 and the car vibrated. Now, about 30 miles further south, I said to Barney, do you believe in flying saucers? And he said, don't be ridiculous. And we heard the second series of beeping sounds. And I turned around and looked out the window, and I saw the town boundary marker for the town of Ashland, New Hampshire. So all we knew was a second beeping sound occurred. And we returned home. Now, when we got home, it was daylight. Which, right from the beginning, I think we thought that the trip had really taken us quite a long period of time. Actually, going over this, it was a distance of 190 miles. And we'd spent 7 hours making the trip. After midnight, much of it turnpike driving, and in fact, Barney was a fast driver. So we had this puzzle right from the beginning. His shoes were scuffed in the tops. My dress was torn. Our watches had stopped functioning. And there were highly polished spots in the trunk of the car which reacted to a compass. But we really didn't know how to explain all this to ourselves. And we both agreed that we were not going to have any publicity about this because, 1961, anyone who saw UFOs was a little bit out of context with reality. So we agreed to keep it to ourselves. But we did, I wrote a letter to NICAP, asking, more or less asking them information with the result that they sent Walton Webb to talk with Bonnie and me. And Walter made several trips and wrote out a report of all this, and then two other scientists came to visit us. And it was, as a result of all this, they suggested that we look around for a good psychiatrist who used hypnosis. Well, we talked with one, and he suggested that we wait. Maybe we can remember what happened in time. So we more or less forgot about it until Bonnie developed an ulcer. Now, his ulcer was not responding to medical treatment. So his doctor thought that it might have an emotional basis. So he sent Bonnie into a psychiatrist in the same building he was in. Bonnie started going to Dr. Stevens, and then one day happened to remember this experience. Dr. Stevens didn't use hypnosis, but a friend of his did. So So he was with both Bonnie and me. The Dr. Benjamin signed in Boston. Bonnie and I started going every Saturday morning for 2 hours. He found that we were both deep trance subjects. Our sessions were done separately, tape recorded, and he caused us to have amnesia so that we could not tell each other or discuss in any way any of the things that we would actually relive it during the sessions. And then at the end, he played the tapes back to us, and this really opened up the amnesia in which we learned, and not only that, we learned it, but we realized at the time we were hearing the tapes that this is what had happened to us. Now, to go back to the first beeping sound, I looked out the window, and I was consciously aware I looked out the window. But I looked up and I'd seen nothing. Everything was dark. Well, under hypnosis, I looked out the window and I looked right up at the bottom of the craft, which was directly over the top. Now, we left Roof Tree, went to 175, off under the side road. And as we did, the humanoids, aliens, the occupants, whatever you want to call them, were in the road, blocking our way. The car motor died, Bonnie couldn't get it started. They separated and came up in two groups, took us out of the car to a path in the woods on board the craft, where they gave us physical examinations. Now, our examinations were both very much alike, in that they examined our eyes, ears, nose, throat, skin. They took scrapings of our skin, samples of our hair, fingernails. Now, with mine, they checked my nervous system, is what they called it. And I tried to insert a needle-like instrument in my navel, with surprise at my causing pain. Now, with Barney, they did about the same thing, only they were interested in his bone structure, in his feet, and they put a cup-like instrument on his abdomen, which developed into a perfect circle of warts. And during the hypnosis, before Barney learned why he had the warts, they became infected and had to be removed, which, as Dr. Simon said, was his subconscious mind learning how he received them and the subconscious mind getting rid of them for him by getting them infected. Now, during Barney's examination, I remained at the first room, Barney was in the second room, and there'd been the leader there, or, if you want to, following the interpreter, because I was able to talk with him and no one else. The examiner had gone into the room where Barney was during his checkup. When the examiner came running back in, and he was all excited, started pulling at my teeth. And he was very puzzled, the leader said, on why Barney's teeth were removable and mine were not. And this led to my attempts to try to explain to him about age, diet, and these things, which I was not able to do. He didn't understand the words I was using or the meanings. And actually, I'm not quite sure my definitions of what I was telling him were correct anyway. So while we were waiting for Barney's exam to be completed, I said to the leader, when I go back home, tell my friends, nobody's going to believe this, so I need some proof. So he gave me a book. And I was delighted about this, this is going to be my proof. So then I said to the leader, I was standing there, where are you from? So he showed me a star map. And they explained the star map to me to some degree. And because this is the important part now, the whole thing is the star map. I'm going to go into that right in the slide. But he showed me the star map. And then Barney's examination was completed, and they came out leaving Barney. He was still sort of this dazed, sort of like sleepwalking. They led him down the ramp. Then I came out, the leader was walking beside me. I'm carrying the book. And then the crew members in back of me, of which there were about 9, start all this. It sounded like a disagreement going on. Their voices were going up and down. And I couldn't understand anything they were saying. So apparently they were having an argument. The leader went back with them for a few moments. And then he came back and he took the book. And I was very angry. I said, but you gave it to me.
He said, well, you're not going to need that. They decided you're going to forget the whole thing. So I said, well, you know, maybe I will and maybe I won't, but I don't intend to forget it if I can help it. So they said, well, maybe you won't forget it, but you should. So he took the book. And then I started walking down the ramp, and he was walking beside me. And he said, why don't you wait and feel free? You'll be safe here by the car. So I went back to the car, and I picked up the dog, who was shivering on the front seat. And Barney got out. We stood there, we leaned against the car, and we saw this object take off. We saw this disc. It was on the ground. It became surrounded by a swirling mass of some kind of orange substance. And the substance was swirling around it, just like a ball revolving. And it lifted up, dipped, and went right straight up, and was gone. We got back in the car. We went back to 175, back to Route 3. I turned around to Barney, and I said, well, Barney, you believe in flying saucers now? And he said, don't be ridiculous. And I thought, he's forgotten already. You know, and if he's forgotten, there's no point in my remembering. So I started a step-by-step forgetting myself. So that is the... Now, I would like to show you some slides.
Yes, let me get the screen set up.
Can I ask one question while the screen is going on? You say that they were talking to you.
Ron was talking. The leader.
Were they talking in English?
I really can't say who said it. I understood it over here.
Was his mouth moving?
Yeah, and also his mouth.
He was so humanoid that there was exact correspondence. He had two eyes, a nose, and a mouth.
I'll show you. We'll see some pictures in that.
Why did he have difficulty understanding about prosthetics, about false teeth, and things like that?
Well, I assume because of the differences between them and us. I have some theories there.
Oh, yeah. In living color, it's so much dope.
Okay, this is Barney Hill. And you can't see it here, but he has a picture. He has a newspaper, which was, you know, we thought we were not going to...
Bill Penny's at the door.
Okay, somebody let Bill Penny in.
We said we were not going to tell anybody about our experience. And we did keep it fairly well quiet. But this newspaper reporter in Boston found out about it. Bits and pieces from different ones. So in 1965, it ran for 5 days in the front pages of the Boston newspaper.
That's
the first issue, and that was the day of the publication, and a newspaper reporter had taken that picture of Barney. Okay, this is a scene from the White Mountains of New Hampshire, because most of the people around here are acquainted. But, you know, when you get out of New England, and I start showing these, everybody starts going, ooh, and ooh.
Yeah, that is a beautiful shot.
But that's, of course, Mount Washington in the back there.
Oh, boy. So this is in the general area in which your sighting took place?
Yeah.
Your abduction?
The Goshen, as you probably know, the Mount Washington is the highest peak east of the Mississippi River, and it's also clocked some of the highest winds in the world. This is another scene from some of the mountains. Okay, this is a scene from the Flume. You can see the bridge there. Now that night, there's a parking area in front of that bridge, off on one side. And Barney and I pulled in here that night and parked and watched this object as it was coming along towards us. This is a scene of Route 3 through Franconia Notch. This is the road we were traveling that night.
Beautiful shots there.
Yep. There's another scene of Route 3. This is a section out of the notch where you can see that the road is narrower. Okay, this is the Cannon Mountain area. Bobby and I were traveling here, and the UFO was actually going right up over the top of Cannon Mountain. And we get it. Now, the next scene shows... This is a slide Barney took from the top of Cannon Mountain, so that you can see the UFO was on the top, and that's the road down there where we were traveling, where they could see us so easily.
Which road is that you were traveling?
That's Route 3. And see, this
Mountain. Right about here is Route 3.
By that lake.
Okay.
because this is at the other end of the Cannon Mountain. Now, Bonnie and I drove along the base of the mountain, and as we came along the base, this was the first place we saw the UFO stop in midair. It was right there in front of the old man on the mountain, waiting for us to come around the bottom. And as we did, and started going past, then it started traveling along beside us again. This is the capture spot. Where I'm standing here is where the occupants were standing in the boat.
Wow.
Only, of course, this is a recent picture, but
that's not Route 3 anymore, is it?
No, this is off from 175. And this was taken a couple of years ago, but in 1961, this was a real narrow road, and it was dirt. Since then, it's been widened and tarred some. But that's where the occupants were standing. This is about the scene that we saw. I don't know if I'm blocking people's view here or not. Okay, I guess I didn't. Okay, now this is a painting that was done by a commercial artist and at Dr. Simon's house. Bonnie was in hypnosis at the time, and Dr. Simon would have Bonnie open his eyes and give suggestions and make corrections in an attempt to get the picture as clear as possible. But that's about what we saw that night.
That's
coming towards us.
It's very close to what you saw, huh?
Right.
Wow. What are they wearing on their head?
Cap.
Cap?
Small cap with a visor.
All of them?
Yep.
Oh.
How many were there?
11. Okay, this is the path, beginning of the path in the woods. The woman who owns this land has now dug a ditch and piled the dirt up and put sticks in it to keep people out of there. Because dirt wasn't there that night. But that's the beginning of the path. And that's going into the woods further with the path.
Was it in the right path?
No, it wasn't too far, but it was a little walk. Because going in that night, you see, now the road, you can see the path is beginning to change. And notice the sand. During the hypnosis, I couldn't figure it out because I kept thinking that I was walking in beach sand. And I couldn't understand how I'd have beach sand in the mountains. And this is the beginning of the sand. That was very, very fine and white, just like beach sand.
Did you notice any in your shoes when you got home?
No. But now this is going into more to the captured the landing spot.
Eddie,
can you see
all
right? Can I ask you a question?
Yes.
Several years of hunting, I believe, before you found what you felt was the right spot. Are you certain that
Yeah, okay. During the hypnosis, or right toward the end of the hypnosis, Dr. Simon said to us, if the capture spot exists, you will find it. You will not look for it. You'll just find it. So one day, we're riding up in the White Mountains with my parents. Actually, we're looking for a place for them to set up their camp up for a couple of weeks. And so we turned onto this road, and we came to the stop sign. And the moment we got there, Bonnie and I knew where we were. And we drove up this road, jumped out of the car, ran in the woods, and there was a clearing. Here's the clearing.
That's sand in there too?
Yeah. And John Oswald took these pictures. John and I have gone up there several different times and taken measurements and all. And as you can see, that lead gap. For my being able to remember where the craft was sitting on the ground, we estimated, well, actually, John took measurements of the opening, which was about 65 feet. So we figured the craft must have been 55 to 60 feet across.
Mm-hmm.
Now this is just another scene of that. See, going in that night, we went in one way, which seemed a long way in, and then we came back a short way, and I think the next scene is the short way. No, that's an overall picture of the clearing itself. Okay, this is the path where we came out, which was different from going in. It was much more open. This is where the leader walked part of the way back to the camp.
And did you have to walk back down this road to your car?
Yeah.
Was it, how far? Just a little?
Just a
little,
just a short distance. Okay, this is where we stopped to watch them leave. I mean, this is where the car was and where we watched them leave here. And that's the direction in which they left. Actually, they went, see, the landing area is over on my right here. And when they left, they dipped down, and because that goes back in the direction of Route 3.
Were the red lights out on the side when they took off? There was the red glow that went around it, you said.
Yeah.
And were the red lights still out on the side and the little
no.
Pins or just the red glow? No,
they just left. It was low and then they were gone completely. Okay, here's another drawing of one of the occupants. This one was also done while Bonnie was hypnotized.
Reminds me of my platoon leader in the Army.
Yeah,
I remember him well. And this is very close to looking what, like what you saw. If not identical, is it identical, would you say? Or very, very close?
Each one was different.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, individual differences. But this is very close.
These were done by individual artists or all by the same?
No, all by the same artists while Bonnie was in hypnosis.
Mm-hmm.
Do they have a membrane in their mouth?
Yeah.
What's that? I'm sorry.
A membrane, you know, a tissue.
Oh.
It looks as though there was something.
Yeah, that's trying to demonstrate the membrane.
The did they strike you as frightened-looking creatures or nice-looking creatures?
I'm going to show you a good-looking one next.
Okay.
Here's a good-looking one.
Hey, if that's a good-looking one, I hate to see an ugly one.
Ready? Did they have teeth?
I don't know. They might have behind the membrane, but I don't know. I didn't see teeth.
Membrane, just the layer of skin onto the...
Yeah, like behind the lips. They're flooded when they talk.
Did the voice actually seem to come from the mouth, or was that something you weren't sure about?
I would say, I don't know. I would assume it did, because that's the only kind of language, you know, way I understand it.
But you did see the mouth moving.
Yeah, on the interpreter.
The lips moving.
Yeah, the leader.
Did the eyes color?
Hmm?
Did she detect color in the
eyes? Dark, very dark.
Did you see any anything in the pupil structure, like a vertical pupil or anything like that, in the eyes?
I'm not sure, but I think I did. Okay, this is the star map that has become so famous. Now, the leader said the two big balls in the corner are trade groups, so they trade back and forth all the time. The other lines are places they go frequently or occasionally. And the broken lines are expeditions. So that's the my map. Now the next one. Now this is one that, this is actually a slide taken of the model, one of the models that Margie Fish did in doing the research.
Where was Earth then?
Hmm?
Where was Earth there?
Where is Earth? And here they are.
Is that the sun or the earth?
That's the sun.
That's our solar system. Star and planets.
Are there a lot of lines going to that particular one or just a couple of them?
Now the lines, this is the kind of modeling Marjorie Fish is starting her research. Let's show one more slide and then we turn the lights on. I'll talk about the star map.
Okay.
If anybody, I don't know if anybody's interested in astronomy.
One more star. Oh yes, we have people.
Okay. Now, I show this because this is good advertising, but the picture of the UFO in the corner, which is down there, that's the shape of the one we saw that night.
Can you lift that up, Chip? Shelly, in fact, we have a couple here that we can pass it around.
Because that yellow underneath is a haze. But that's a real picture taken by a boy down in Pennsylvania, and you've probably seen it published quite often. He was out photographing the moon, and the UFO came along. So that's his picture.
So that is a real picture there.
That's a real picture. So that's the end of the slide.
Betty, can I ask you a question about the book? You said they gave you a book. Did you open the book?
I opened the book.
Was it a hardcover book?
Mm-hmm.
Did it have, was it printed with black and printing on white paper or what?
It was similar to a book of ours, but it was still different. and it was symbols that went, there were five columns, mm-hmm. went up and down. And symbols like I've never seen.
Were the pages numbered, or do you know whether they looked from
I wouldn't know what their numbers are.
He didn't indicate whether they read from front to back.
There were only five characters across the
page. Five columns up and down.
More than one character in each column.
Oh, yeah, there were. Each thing was different.
Printed on both sides of the page, and we opened it up, we saw both pages.
Yeah.
Both sides. And the five columns were five on this page and five on this, so ten altogether.
It was a book, though, with a similar binding to what we would have with hardcover?
It was similar to a book that we would have, but it was not paper.
It was something, some other material.
The pages were stiff, and they were very, very thin, and very, very smooth.
Mm-hmm. Can you say something more about the star map? It's really a 3D map.
All right, let me go into, here's a map over here, if you can see it, but I'll go into this. Now, when I saw this on board the craft, it was sort of a reflective holograph. It was like, even though it was flat, it was like almost like looking out a window and seeing this. Now, Marjorie Fish was reading the book, and she wondered if by any chance this map could actually exist. So she started doing research. She started out with three assumptions. She started out with the assumption that their home base had to be on the map, that we, our solar system, would have to be on the map, and that the places they went would have to be logical, would have to have common sense, and have to be based on the assumption that they were humans, therefore they were looking for humans. They would be looking for life like they know it, which would be possibly us. A carbon-based form of life. So Marjorie started out building models, strings and beads and different colored beads, and started building out from there. Well, in the area that I saw in this map, there's about 1,000 stars. So Marjorie had to start the process of elimination. Now, I don't know, any astronomers here?
Well, David, brother in Longwood, the man that he was discussing, he's an astronomer, right?
Yeah, well,
we're all
good
friends. So, Marjorie and we had to start on eliminating stars, trying to find stars, and when I say stars, I mean suns. Suns that possibly have planets revolving around them. That would be the kind that could support advanced life. So she used the Gliese catalog of nearby stars, which is the same one that all the governments used in getting our own spacecraft out. And this is the one that's recognized as the best. So she had 1,000 stars and she had to start eliminating them. So she got rid of all the white dwarfs and all the giants and supergiants, which was 9% of the 1,000. Then she got rid of all the star systems that have multiple suns, double suns, or three suns, because it's believed that if they have three suns, this would have the orbits would not be right. The planets would be bouncing back and forth, and life couldn't develop, and they'd be freezing and frying from being too close. So those were all discarded. Then she discarded all the, what they call, AO to F4 stars, which are the ones that have a very hot, rapidly burning sun, would be too hot for the development of life, and also would not last, would not exist long enough for life to develop. She got rid of those. She got rid of all the K and M stars, which we believe have planets, but also have sun flares that give off lethal doses of radiation. And feeble light output, and all these things. So that when Marjorie got through, she had F8s, all the G stars, and of course our son's a G2, and K1 stars, which meant that she had what they call main sequence stars, which have, by our research, the proper temperature, the proper mass, the proper brightness of the sun, and the proper lifespan for life to develop. So when she got all through, she had 46 stars out of 1,000. And out of those 46 stars,
I have 16. And that, you know, that's about a million in one shot if somebody was just going to do a hoax. Now, in doing this, apparently Zeta 1 and Zeta 2 reticulate the home base. Now, what we know about them is that their son, the son of these two, is identical to our son, based on, by the way, this is Astronomy Magazine, if you haven't seen it. This is Astronomy Magazine, Terrence Dickinson wrote an article about Madtree's research. And at the time, this was just a small select magazine that only astronomers bought, and it made him a national publication. So what they did is they put out this special issue which deals just with the research in my lab. It's on the newsstands now. But
what month issue is that, Patty?
It came out in January, but it's a special one that people will be able to get. And here's the age. Now this is the part that I like, because this is where I get all my theories from. The age of nearby stars, which is in here, in which they break it down as to the disk stars and the halo stars, and the population one, the older population two, you know. And on the thinking that the metal, if a star, the amount of metal is found in a star by study, would have a relationship with their age. So based on that, we know that we, because we know this from our research on the moon, though, we've been around about 4.6 billion years. Zeta 1 and Zeta 2 have been around 6 to 8 billion. And some of these here that have the solid lines have been 10 billion. The broken lines are the expeditions. They've only been there once. And those are all stars that are younger than we are. So, my thinking is that what Zeta 1 and Zeta 2 are doing is really going out and looking over all the nearby stars around them and sort of studying them as to the stages of development of life. Because they seem to be going from places 1 billion, 4 billion, 6 billion, 10 billion. And so they're sort of taking an overall look at life around them.
Excuse me, buddy, how far away is that planet
from ours? Zeta 1? Zeta 2? 37 and a half light years. And actually, Zeta 1 and Zeta 2 are close together. I think something like 350 billion miles. But they could look out and actually see each other, both daytime and nighttime. You know, and the planets would look
like
they
can
huge.
See, they can see planets.
Yeah, they would be able to
put a planet around Zeta 1, you can see planets around Zeta 2.
Right,
you know there are planets out there.
Right, so that they'd be able to really look out and take a good look at each other. And this would probably, you know, motivate them to get out into space as soon as possible to, you know, go hopping around to see who's out there. But Dr. Walter Mitchell had his astronomy class set up the computer with all the stars and all, and had it set up so that the computer was at Zeta 1 and Zeta 2, looking back towards us. And when they did this, the computer map was just like the one that Marjorie had done. And Marjorie, by the way, Marjorie's no longer teaching school. She's doing, she's out in Oak Ridge, Tennessee, working on nuclear research for the government. The only thing I have left to show you is Zeta Junior.
Who's Zeta Junior? Oh, what is it?
This is a model done by an artist, which is based on 200 reports by eyewitnesses. Their description.
Is that
the flat nose, the thin slit for the mouth, the large eyes. See the profile, how flat it is?
Maybe hold it over more in back of the light there. Yeah, stand. That's it. And hold it down near the light so people can. That's it. That's good.
Teddy, how would they consume food if they had the mouth?
Food?
Yes.
I don't know if they eat. We'll find out more when they open up the hypnosis of Travis Walton.
You said that your watches were stopped, and I'd like to know if both your watches were reading the same time and if that would indicate.
What we didn't put any significance on it.
Did you notice what time they read?
Nope. You know, your watch stops, it still tries to start, and you change the time.
Yeah. the Dublin Gal. And well, I did you have a clock in the car or in the same gal?
Does anybody have a clock in a car that works?
Yes. Yes. Yes.
But I know what time the UFO left.
Why would you know that?
Because Pete Air Force Base picked it up on radar. Yeah, because it was seen, they clocked it at 2:14 a.m.
And that was recently released.
Well, 1970.
Yeah, I like that. Oh, are you still asking?
Sorry, what was the time?
2:14 a.m.
Would you agree that the Air Force Blue Book and the O'Connor reports, do you agree as to the percent of settings being unexplained or being unidentified, which these two reports give? And quoting Stanton Friedman, he states that 19.7%, in fact, he stated this on the show that you were on, so you heard him say this before.
That's what Tom Snyder.
19.7 unexplained from Special Project Blue Book. And from Connor Report, 30% unexplained, according to Stan Friedman. Yeah. Do you think these figures are fairly accurate, in your opinion, or do you think... well, I'll let you answer that.
Actually, any explanation... There's been very few explanations the Air Force has given that I agree with. So I don't think that... Really, it was set up to do... They didn't have the equipment or the men or the training or all to do... explanations, and I think it's very good that they're out of the whole area.
Do you think this is an accurate figure? If this works out to a mean figure of about 25% unexplained sightings, would you say that there are approximately 25%?
I would say more than that.
Mm-hmm. What would you put it at if you... what I'm trying to say is, of all the sightings that have been reported, they found out that they could only explain 75% of them, 25% on the mean figure they couldn't explain.
Well, since they don't accept UFOs, I think a lot of their explanation that they want to start with something. But, all right, with me, they started out, it was the planet Jupiter who followed us. I know better than that. Then it was an air inversion. And then finally it became insufficient data.
I've got a question. Yes. You mentioned that the solid lines represent...
These lines here represent where they go occasionally or frequently.
So did you get the impression they had been to our sun and to our earth several times?
They're around quite a bit.
Okay. They come several times.
I don't know how many, what a trip would be or how long, would a trip be 100 years?
I think what he's saying is according to the map and its symbols, I see that the sun there isn't a broken line, whereas the broken line indicated just...
One trip, expedition. So apparently they've been here.
On more than one occasion?
Right.
Okay.
Either occasionally or frequently.
You said something about the spots on the car that had some kind of magnetic properties. Can you say anything more about that?
They were highly polished spots about the size of a silver dollar. And it was sort of scattered around in a place about this big.
On the truck.
And when you put a compass, the compass just went spinning.
This was a 57 Bel Air Chevy. Was it, what color was the trunk lit? Blue, a navy blue?
No, quite blue.
Bright blue, sort of a baby blue, such as her sweater, her blouse? Or was it a dark blue?
I'd say it was a little darker than that.
Okay, I was just wondering what the color was or what the pigmentosis was. I noticed that sometimes, for instance, I don't know if you've ever noticed anybody here, but black and navy blue cars, when they get faded, they sort of, pigmentosis and effect occurs in the discoloration, if you would.
Yeah.
And this has been noted. In regards to the spots...
Can I just...
Sure, I'm sorry.
If they kept spinning, just continuously?
Yeah, just bouncing around. Without, because you put it like...
Put it anywhere else on the car, or would it not?
It would act like a regular compass. You hold it up over the car and point to the north, but if you put it where the spots were, it would just spin.
Betty, you said that...
I'm still running around with a compass, by the way.